Eyes near 22. It's 6 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
First, the diplomatic shift, now the night shift. Denmark's government is working overtime to deal with Donald Trump's second presidency. I mean that literally, because of his constant musings about annexing Greenland, the Foreign Affairs Ministry now has an overnight team monitoring the U.S. president.
And all craters, great and small. Archaeologists now know who made a bunch of large pits near Stonehenge and when, and those are both major discoveries. Now, all they have to do is figure out why anyone would dig them in the first place.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of As It Happens.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this Friday and Saturday, November 28th and 29th in Grand Rapids and La Porte. First up, Doyle Turner and Sarah Morris are playing at the Popple Bar in La Porte Friday at 6 p.m. The pair collaborated on Turner's latest Paper Maps release, and Morris just put out a new album called Say Yes in October. Both are talented songwriters and singers who blend jazz, pop, and Americana. Friday in La Porte at the Popple Bar. Next up, a pair of Mankato songwriters are playing at Rapids Brewing Friday night at 6. Nate Boots is an Americana and folk musician who has led bands like the High Horses and Porchlights. He just released a solo album called A Stretch of a Wing, a Leap. Murphy is an up-and-coming folk rocker who recently released a great new single called Sugar. Nate Boots and Mal Murphy in Grand Rapids this Friday. It's a busy night in Rapids, with Brothers Burn Mountain coming to Clocko Brewing at 7 p.m. The eclectic duo from Cotton, Minnesota recently released a best-of album to celebrate their 25-year anniversary. Their live show features a drum-heavy mix of psychedelic blues, rock, and folk music. Friday at 7 p.m. Finally, Dave Simonette is playing at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids Saturday at 7. The Trampled by Turtles frontman is returning after a sold-out Dead Man Winter show in early 2024. Since then, he released 5 new original songs recorded by both Trampled and Dead Man Winter and collaborated with Alan Sparhawk of Low. It is Dave Simonette this Saturday at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
That's Malachi Coons telling us about some of the live music in our region. You can tell us more or text 218-326-1234. Thanks so much for being here. We've got some music coming up and then more news this time from the Canadian Broadcast Corporation. Right now, it's the Heartland Lakes Community Tree Lighting in downtown Grand Rapids. You can find Santa and Mrs. Claus at Bella Cafe. We receive support from the Bonner Eye Clinic in introducing Dr. Abby Spurr to their team at both locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing, performing routine eye exams, assisting with post-op care after surgery, and more. BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. And thanks goes out to Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. It's time now for our album of the week. It is Silvana Estrada. Let's take a listen.
Si te quedas, dime si es de veras esta vez. Dime qué vamos a hacer ahora, falsos simulacros en la piel. ¿Cuál era la idea de aventarte sin dejarte caer? ¿Qué manera tan desoladora de querer?
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
the hardest no. A BC Indigenous leader says he is not interested in sitting down with a minister from Alberta's government because he is never going to support a bitumen pipeline.
Under fire, there are furious calls for accountability after a video of what the UN is calling an apparent summary execution by Israeli border police is broadcast. A human rights advocate tells us that that accountability will not happen.
Watching his language, after Donald Trump's threats to annex Greenland, Denmark's Foreign Affairs Ministry establishes a new night watch of bureaucrats who keep an eye on the U.S. president while the rest of Copenhagen is sleeping.
A sorry oversight. After months of pressure, Nova Scotia releases a draft report from a special panel on environmental racism. Our guest tells us it's about time the province answers the call for a formal apology.
Hollow victory. Archaeologists say they now have hard evidence that a ring of large pits discovered near Stonehenge were made by humans some 4,000 years ago. But the why? Well, that's still a bit of a mystery.
I think I know. And no such thing as a free munch. A South Korean man was charged with theft after taking about a dollar's worth of treats from the office refrigerator. And after his employer takes him to court, he finds himself smack dab in the middle of a major case. As It Happens, the Friday edition, radio that shares an embarrassment of fridges. The Alberta government has a truly enormous sales job on its hands. Yesterday, Premier Danielle Smith was celebrating a memorandum of understanding with the federal government, which endorses her proposal, a pipeline to take Alberta oil to the Pacific Ocean. There are a few roadblocks in the way, one of which is several hundred kilometers wide. It's called British Columbia. The province has repeatedly and loudly voiced its opposition to a pipeline, and then there are the numerous coastal Indigenous communities that are not keen to see oil tanker traffic welcomed into their waters and onto their shores. Next week, Alberta's Indigenous Relations Minister, Rajan Saini, is planning to visit BC Indigenous leaders to make her case for a pipeline. Here she is speaking to the Calgary Eye-Opener this morning.
I know that everybody is not going to be on board. We understand that, you know, the route of the pipeline and ultimately the water and the land provide sustenance for these communities. So it's critically important that we really hear, that we really listen, and we really address those concerns. So at the moment, as I said, there is quiet support and there is some opposition, but there's also a flexibility and a willingness to speak. I'm very hopeful and somewhat confident as well that we are going to have more support at the table than anybody can anticipate at this point.
Gauguis Jason Alsop is the president of the Council of the Haida Nation. We reached him in Old Masset, Haida Gwaii.
Gauguis Jason Alsop, will you be accepting the minister's invitation to sit down and talk about this pipeline?
At this time, you know, we need to have dialogue with the government of Canada, you know, who's helped initiate this MOU. And through the Coastal First Nations, we've reached out to the Prime Minister's office for a direct conversation, and that's where we want to begin.
And have you received a response yet?
We have not. We have not heard from the Prime Minister's office to set up a time. And, you know, our attempts to reach Minister Hodgson, they didn't make time for us until last minute, and we weren't able to accommodate that.
And I hear you when you say you're focused on communicating with the federal government, but have you spoken at all to Alberta's government? Have they reached out directly to you?
The minister has tried to make contact, but, you know, we are not interested in talking to the minister at this point. Like I said, our focus is to have a direct dialogue government to government with the Prime Minister.
The minister has also said that there is, and certainly no community is a monolith, but the minister is saying there that there is, as they put it, quiet support among some in British Columbia, First Nations, for a pipeline. What are people in your community telling you?
People in my community are telling me absolutely not. Never, not just the Haida Nation and Haida citizens, but islanders, people who live on Haida Gwaii, who we all stood together against the last attempt to develop a pipeline with the Northern Gateway Project. And mm-hmm. Our position remains the same as a collective for Haida Gwaii.
You likely heard yesterday, BC's Premier David Eby says, you know, he expressed his concerns about all of this. He also said, though, that he wouldn't put this to a court challenge. And he understands, he knows, although he wouldn't like it, but he says he knows that the federal government could impose this on British Columbia. What will you do if this project does go ahead?
We will defend our rights and title and uphold our responsibility to look after Haida Gwaii. And if that includes, you know, challenging the honor of the crown and how they choose to pursue this project through the courts, that is an avenue we have to consider. And if you really actually look at it, you know, bringing a pipeline and tanker traffic into the Heckett Strait, into the most, some of the most roughest waters in the world, is dangerous and risky. And it's, you know, we're not talking about this in reality.
There is, to let our listeners know, a ban on oil tankers over a certain size from certain areas along the northern coast of British Columbia. You hinted at some of your biggest concerns there, but if the law was modified in order to get a pipeline built, what are the worst-case scenarios in your mind?
The worst-case scenario is a crude oil tanker spill, and we know crude oil is amongst the heaviest and dirtiest of oil products. And there's no way to clean it up. There's no technology. The impacts will last for generations. And that is a major risk and one that we're not willing to consider.
You know, we've talked about other deals that the federal government has made with different First Nations communities, and there's division often between various communities. Obviously, there are different ways of thinking about it, different thoughts on these kinds of projects that the government has said are nation building. But you know, for those who might feel that there could somewhere be an economic benefit for the Haida Nation, what would you say to them?
Oh, there is no interest in any kind of economic deals. This isn't about making money or profit or greed. For us, this is about looking after our home, a place we've existed for well over 10,000 years and longer. And, you know, really, if we look at it, Canada and BC are new creations. Our Indigenous nations, our governance systems have been around for thousands of years looking after this place. And this can't be a knee-jerk, short-term reaction to what's happening in the South, when reality is, by the time any of this, if it was as proposed, would take a long time, and the whole world will have changed. There'll be elections, there'll be a whole nother reality we'll be dealing with. So I think we just forget about this and move on to where areas where governments and people are aligned.
What signal did the announcement of that MOU, the way it was rolled out, what kind of message or signal did that send to you and the Haida Nation?
It was a signal of disrespect for the Coastal First Nations, for the Haida Nation, for not engaging Canada, not engaging directly, not including British Columbia, you know, who's also, we've come out together in support of upholding the Oil Tanker Moratorium Act. So, you know, really, again, this is all about our relationships and reconciliation in Canada between Indigenous nations and the governments. And, you know, these things need to be done together and done carefully.
I spoke with Calgary Liberal MP Corey Hogan last night in the aftermath of Stephen Guilbeault's resignation and the announcement of this memorandum of understanding. And he, as the government press releases have said, is that First Nations consultation is of utmost importance, that is going to happen. I don't hear in your voice much confidence that you feel that is a priority. Is that the correct assessment of how you're feeling right now?
Well, you know, again, consultation, we're open to talking to people, but not if it's a process that's driven towards getting to a predetermined end result. And we know from experience that these environmental processes, this major projects list, they're all geared towards getting to yes and mitigating your concerns. And in this case, there's nothing that can mitigate a crude oil spill in the Heckett Strait on the north coast around Haida Gwaii, nothing that can clean it up. So there's nothing to mitigate there.
Gagwis, I'm very glad we could speak. I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And just to close, I just want to again share with your listeners that, you know, we're not here just to say no to everything, that this is the one thing that's really, it's totally off the table, and that in Haida territorial waters, we are accommodating a great deal of shipping from the Port of Prince Rupert in a significant projected increase in shipping through the Dixon Entrance and Hecate Strait, and there's already a significant amount of risk in our waters transiting all around Haida Gwaii. So this is about not adding to it, and there is no proper risk assessment or long-term planning. So, you know, that needs to be understood.
Gagwis, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Okay, Hawa, thank you.
Gagwis Jason Alsop is the president of the Council of the Haida Nation. We reached him in Old Masset, Haida Gwaii.
Witness to my vow. Night gathers, and now my watch begins. It shall not end until my death.
That is the sound of Game of Thrones heartthrob Jon Snow becoming a member of the Night's Watch, a military order sworn to protect the people of Westeros from evils that lurk in its northernmost reaches. These evils included White Walkers, silent, super creepy, with voices, in the words of author George R.R. Martin, like the cracking of ice on a winter lake. So that Night's Watch is quite different from the newly established Night Watch set up by Denmark's Foreign Affairs Ministry, although that didn't stop The Guardian from making the comparison. I mean, for one thing, unlike Mr. Snow, the Danish watch ends at dawn, as opposed to death. For another, the voice of the person they're monitoring is nothing like the cracking of ice on a winter lake. This new unit is tasked with keeping an eye on Donald Trump while everyone else is asleep. Its existence was first reported by political journalist Jesper Tobo Carlsen and his colleagues at the Danish daily Politiken. We reached Mr. Tobo Carlsen in Copenhagen.
Jesper, we and people around the world now know about it, thanks to your reporting. But this Night Watch unit was actually established some time ago, earlier this year. Why?
Well, as you experienced in Canada as well, there was a tectonic shift when Donald Trump all of a sudden threatened our country and territorial integrity of Denmark and Greenland. And I think the Foreign Service realized that they needed a better heads up going forward. So they put they picked 20 people, mid-level civil servants, and they take turn having the night watch in Denmark ever since.
And so what from what time to what time is Denmark's night watch?
Yeah, they meet at 5 o'clock, 5 p.m., mm-hmm. and they stay there when everybody else goes home. And they have a bed. They can take a nap if it's a slow night. And they leave at 9 o'clock. And if something happens, they prepare a case file for the people that come in the morning.
And specifically, what are some of the things the U.S. president was saying about Denmark that really were so upsetting, clearly, to bring in these new hours?
Yeah, it started in December of 24 when really out of the blue. Of course, there had been in the first Trump period, he talked about wanting to buy Greenland, but then that was put away and nobody really knew what was, if it was going to resurface. And then in December, he all of a sudden he writes on Truth Social that the acquiring of an ownership of Greenland is fundamental for U.S. security, and he appoints a new ambassador to Denmark with that task.
And so, as you're hinting there, you know, Denmark has done and is doing other things. This new night watch is just part of the strategy. What else is the country doing?
Yeah, so there has been an upgrade in personnel at the embassy. Quite a few extra people at the embassy in Washington. Also, the Greenland government has a part of the embassy in Washington. They have also manned up, staffed up. They're doing several things. They're trying to reach out to the MAGA movement, which is a new middle ground or gray area for diplomacy. It there's a lot of private people, a lot of business people that are important to know if you want to know what's going on in the MAGA world. The other part is trying to set straight a lot of the misinformation about Greenlanders really wanting to be Americans.
And we haven't really heard from Donald Trump on Greenland, annexing Greenland, for quite some time now. Do you think Denmark's strategy is working?
No, I think the Denmark's has a very our ability to influence what is going on in his world is precious little. I think what it gives us is a heads up, and I think his strategy towards Denmark in particular has backfired. The first stage was about trying to intimidate Denmark, and that didn't work. There was a pushback from both Denmark and Greenland to that. And the next phase was about trying to put a wedge in between to pull Denmark and Greenland apart. There was a lot of talk in that period about the old wounds and grievances that, of course, the history between Denmark and Greenland is one of colonialism. So, you know, he was trying to pull out those old grievances and play them. But that also backfired. And when the U.S. government tried to set up a meeting alone with the new prime minister in Greenland, they said no, they declined. They wouldn't do that without Denmark. So I think it has really pulled us together, Denmark and Greenland.
We know there's a new ambassador to Denmark sent by Washington earlier this month, Ken Howery. What does his arrival suggest to you about where this relationship might go next?
Well, I think we're in a phase where the civil service in the U.S. is, I think they know as little as we do about what his next move might be. But in the absence of any new indications of aggression, they make nice and they try to normalize relations. So he has arrived in Denmark being very amiable and talking about resetting or strengthening relations. But when asked, he cannot rule out a military intervention either. So in that area of ultimate insecurity, this is where we live at the moment.
So what does that mean for people living across Denmark? I mean, what's your sense of how they're feeling? Has what your country has done, this night watch and all of the other things, helped, you know, bring down any anxiety?
I think we're realizing, and I think the night watch is a symbol of that, that we are just living in a different world now, and the new normal is that nobody knows. And I think the ambassador doesn't, the U.S. ambassador doesn't know. Nobody really knows, outside of Donald Trump, where this is going. If this has died out, he would never say so. So obviously, if he did give up, this is what it would look like, because he would never admit to that. But we don't know. It might come back. It might come back in a different form. And when nobody knows where your old and most important ally is heading, you have to stay up at night and keep watch.
Jesper, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jesper Tobo Carlson is a journalist in the foreign editorial office of the Danish daily Politiken. We reached him in Copenhagen. About 5 years ago, archaeologists made a huge discovery near Stonehenge. I know that happens a lot, but this one was really actually big, possibly the largest prehistoric monument ever discovered in Britain.
These things are at least 10 meters across and 5 meters deep. You could drop a trilithon from Stonehenge into one of these things. In fact, most rooms in a house would fit in one of these pits, and we've got dozens of them.
Archaeologist Vincent Gaffney describing a ring of large shafts or holes that his team discovered surrounding Durrington Walls, about 3 kilometers from Stonehenge, on our program back in 2020. Well, now Professor Gaffney and his team say they have hard evidence that these massive holes were man-made. They've published their study, The Perils of Pits, in the journal Internet Archaeology. Christopher Gaffney is an archaeological geophysicist and one of the authors of the study. He also happens to be Vincent Gaffney's brother. We reached Christopher Gaffney in Bradford, England.
Professor, two brothers, both studying Stonehenge. Did you two, as children, have a particularly consequential trip to this site? How did you both get into this?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, we had a very curious grandfather, and we spent a lot of times traveling out to Hadrian's Wall. Now, obviously, that's a very different period to Stonehenge, but actually one of the very first excavations that Vince and I worked on together was at a place called Conebryhenge, which is just south of Stonehenge. And that was back in, oh gosh, I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but it was 1978.
All right.
It's quite extraordinary.
As we heard there, your brother gave a bit of a description, quite a vivid one, of these holes. For someone who's never seen them, what would you add to that? How would you describe them?
Well, I'd actually describe them as invisible. And, you know, if you walked across the landscape, you simply could not see these features.
And they were known about these holes, at least in part, for years. You've now found evidence that leads you to believe they were made by human beings. But what were the theories up until now?
Yeah.
Who else or what else would have made them?
If they're natural, people have suggested there might be sinkholes and into the chalk, and they just don't fit the common conception of sinkholes. We are very confident that they have been dug, because we inserted boreholes into these features, and we know that they are classically about 5 meters depth, all of them. They have three very distinct layers within them, and some of these features haven't, at the very bottom, or haven't actually seen light into the bottom of these pits since 2.5 millennia BC. So, you know, we've got a really sound date on them. But interestingly, the stratigraphy that we've been able to chart through the chemical analysis and the DNA within the soils is common across the pits that we've looked at. And that really is not a natural phenomenon in this landscape. So we're really happy that these things are not natural.
And ultimately, why do you believe people 4,000 years ago would have dug these huge holes? What did they want to do with them?
That's always the question. And I'm not sure if I can answer that 100%. And what you've got to remember is there's lots of weird things happen in the Neolithic. You know, in things which must have been very, very commonplace and quite logical to the people at the time, which to us just doesn't seem to make much sense. Now, they're digging down 5 meters. Now, that's an extraordinary depth, really, in the Neolithic.
Yeah.
So they're using antler picks and so on. And our best bet at the moment is that it's something to do with the underworld. You know, it's a different space they want to be part of. And there's, within these pits, we can see there's evidence of cattle, of sheep, but there's differences between the northern set of pits and the southern set of pits. So there's something also going on with the animals that are associated with these huge features as well.
You know, we often say on our show, Professor, because we've covered Stonehenge, different aspects and facets of it many, many times, we sort of joke that every time there's a discovery that has anything to do with Stonehenge, it could be very incremental. We love it. The audience loves it. Why do you think there is such a fascination with stories about Stonehenge? Clearly, you're still fascinated.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's every archaeologist's dream to work within the Stonehenge area. That's the first thing. But the work that we've been involved with has really, we've turned our back on Stonehenge itself, and we've looked in the landscape around it. And I think that's the thing that really fascinates me, and I think fascinates an awful lot of people. There's the concept of where people are living, and you know, and basically the areas where there's ritual. Stonehenge is part of ritual. It's part of our ancestry about how we live in a natural environment. You know, we know an awful lot about Stonehenge. We know an awful lot about the landscape around it, but there's so many new things to discover. Mm. And that's why we keep going back there.
More secrets yet to be revealed. Professor, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Okay, lovely to talk to you.
Christopher Gaffney is an archaeological geophysicist at the University of Bradford, and he's in Bradford. The crime began innocently enough. A security guard in South Korea took two snacks from a shared office fridge. And it ended innocently enough because that's all he did. And yet it didn't actually end. It's been nearly 2 years since the unnamed guard took and ate one choco pie, a moon pie-like treat worth 42 cents, and one mini custard cake worth 56 cents. At the time, he thought nothing of it, except presumably, these taste good. So he was understandably surprised when a few weeks later, the company accused him of theft. And he was understandably even more surprised when police pursued the complaint and charged him. He's been fighting the case in the courts ever since. Now, the company argued that he had no right to take anything from the office fridge because he was a subcontractor, not a staff member. The man argued that employees had told him to help himself and that he suspected he was actually being punished for joining a union, which he had done shortly before his act of malicious snacking. I would argue that anyone who is brave enough to eat anything in an office fridge should be rewarded. An initial guilty verdict in April sparked public outrage and pointed criticism from lawmakers, and now, after an appeal, he's been acquitted. That's a big win for him. Of course, he has spent many thousands in legal fees, but I'm sure it was worth it to defend such a nibble cause. Their version of Been Caught Stealing.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return,
a new sculpture park in Miami does not require a ticket, but it does require scuba gear. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you.
More from As It Happens up next. I'm Heidi. More from As It Happens up next. I'm Heidi Holton at 6:35. Thanks for tuning in. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected at watchictv.org. We also receive support this evening from Bemidji Brewing, embracing the cooler weather with the release of several seasonal beers this November, including the Winter IPA, Holiday Ale, and Icebox Dark Lager. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, it is On the River with your volunteer host, Diane Ott. Chance of flurries tonight, cloudy skies, lows 10 to 15. Tomorrow, Saturday, slight chance of snow, mostly cloudy, highs near 22. And by Sunday, mostly cloudy, 15 to 18 during the day. Evening temperatures from 1 below to 5 below zero. You can listen to the new Season Watch pod with host Charlie Mitchell, myself, I'm Heidi Holton, and John Latimer. This week, we're talking about what you do if you find a raptor on the side of the road.
They raised their hands, appearing to be unarmed and surrendering. Moments later, Israeli border police shot them dead. Video of the incident yesterday shows two Palestinian men emerging from a building in the West Bank city of Jenin. The men hold up their shirts and then lift their arms. The border police then appear to direct them back into the building before shooting them at close range. In a statement responding to footage of the incident, Israeli Defense Forces have described the victims as, quote, wanted individuals who had carried out terror activities, including hurling explosives and firing at security forces, unquote. Shai Parnas is a spokesperson for B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the occupied territories. We reached him in Tel Aviv.
Shai, in condemning what has happened, what is seen in this video, the United Nations describes it as a, quote, apparent summary execution, unquote. What do you see when you watch this?
Well, it's pretty obvious. It is an execution. We see Israeli forces taking these two Palestinians out of the building, searching them, seeing that they hold no weapons, then kicking them on the ground, pointing them back to the building while they pose no threats to the forces, and just shoot them. Right after that, they were seeing the tractor demolish the building itself. It's an execution that this time it just happened in front of the cameras.
What does it suggest to you about this stage in this ongoing conflict?
Well, I have to say, it's first of all, it's nothing new. We've seen just like 3 or 4 months ago, another Israeli, this time a settler, shoot Oud Adalin, and it was published again all over the world. But this settler got total impunity, as everyone in Israel gets, whether it's a soldier or a settler, while harming Palestinian. And that's the outcome of a total dehumanization of Palestinians by Israel in the last couple of years.
The militant group Palestinian Islamic Jihad is reportedly saying these two men were fighters in its Al-Quds brigades. The IDF says that it is investigating. Israel's national security minister is defending these killings and calling these men terrorists. We know that under international law, the execution of unarmed prisoners or anyone showing intent to surrender is considered a war crime. But given everything that we know at this point, the responses so far, do you have hope that there will be accountability at the end of an investigation?
There isn't actually any internal mechanism in Israel that willing or able to investigate these kind of conducts. We've seen that in many, many cases. Basically, all the investigative mechanism in Israel are part of a whitewash mechanism, which their goal is not to reach out for the truth, is to cover up and whitewash Israel crimes. So we've heard these for many, many years and decades, but what's bothering is that the international community also gives Israel total impunity for all the crimes it's committing against Palestinian people.
There was a time when your organization used to cooperate with military reviews of these types of incidents to try to get answers. You stopped doing that back in 2016. Why did you stop that then?
Well, after almost three decades of trying to bring justice to the Palestinians' victims, we've seen in so many cases that this Israel mechanism is not about bringing justice, it's just about to cover up and whitewash the Israeli crimes. So all the way back to 2016, we decided as an organization to stop playing along with this charade because it doesn't give any hope for the Palestinians or the victims. It's not an accident, it's the policy.
What have you seen, I don't know if you've been into the occupied West Bank, but since the Israeli military's latest operation there, after the ceasefire deal was agreed to, what are you seeing there, you and your colleagues?
Nothing happened since the so-called ceasefire declaration. The genocide is still ongoing. More than 300 people, Palestinians in Gaza, were killed since the declaration. Other than that, it has no effect whatsoever about what's going on in the West Bank. We just last week published that more than 1,000 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank since October 2023. So along with the Israel genocidal campaign in Gaza, there is also a campaign of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank. At least 44 Palestinians' shepherding communities were forcibly transferred due to army raids and settler violence. So Israel unchecked violence all over the land and use unchecked violence in all the territories it holds.
What can be done to stop it at this stage? If, as you say, you're worried that the investigation will lead nowhere. Your organization is no longer cooperating, hasn't been for a decade, with these kinds of investigations because you feel that there's no point to it. What can you do as an organization? What can be done?
Well, as an organization, we're doing what human rights organization, I believe, supposed to do, is to investigate, to verify, to publish, to analyze the situation on the ground with our eyes open. So we're fully aware of what's going on and how the politicians here also and the decision makers speak. I have to say that at least this current Israel government, they are sincere. They were talking about their will to demolish Gaza, to destroy Gaza, to do total blockade on Gaza. On the first days of this criminal Hamas attack on October 7th, and they did so. And they talk pretty much the same about the West Bank. But what's really troubling is the total impunity Israel gets for the genocidal campaign and the in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank from the world, and especially from Western countries and leaders. So by now, it's totally on the hands and in the responsibility of Western leaders and countries to stop Israel's total impunity.
Shai, I thank you for this. Please take care.
Thank you.
Shai Parnas is the public outreach director at the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem. We reached him in Tel Aviv. Kingsville, Ontario, was exceptionally windy on Wednesday night, and for local scuba diver Matt Vermette, that was a great reason to leave the house. The gusts were so strong they were pushing the water of Lake Erie away from the shore, so much that Mr. Vermette suspected he might spot something he wouldn't be able to see as well while diving, because the shallow water by the shoreline is really muddy. And he was right. He came across a rarely unveiled treasure of a sort that quickly disappeared once the water came back early the next day.
Yeah, I said, I'm going to go for a walk. And my wife said, you're nuts. So I was just going to go out. And because, I mean, when the water goes out that far, you're bound to find something. But I certainly didn't expect to find a shipwreck. And I did some measurements. I dropped a map point on Google Maps, and it's about 160 yards out from shore. And it was just really cool. I saw some birds sitting on a structure. I thought, oh, maybe it's an old dock or something, right? And as I got closer, I said, no, that's definitely a shipwreck. And then when I saw it was a lot of mortise and tenon and handmade nails and things like that, then I got really excited because now I know this thing's really old. It's not somebody's boat that got off their dock in the last few years or anything. I did send some pictures to some of the local historians that know shipwrecks and do that stuff, and we've kind of come up with it could be one of two wrecks. In an old book about Kingsville, there's a mention of the Deming that was just west of Kingsville Harbor, and in 1908, they have a record of them going skating out on the ice to go see the shipwreck sticking out of the ice. And then there's some news from the Emmitsburg Echo from 1877 about a schooner that went down called the Overton, again just west of the Kingsville docks, and it also fits the description of the wreckage we found, so it could be either one of those wrecks. If it was the Overton, it came into port and it got holed up there, and the storm kind of blew it out up onto the beach, and that it just wrecked it, so it stayed there.
Kingsville, Ontario scuba diver Matt Vermette speaking to CBC Windsor. It's been 2 years since the Nova Scotia government appointed a special panel on environmental racism. And now there are a lot of questions about that panel's report. When was it delivered to the government? Relatedly, how long has the government been sitting on it? And both of those questions aside, what is the government going to do about it? On Wednesday, the CBC reported on the panel's recommendations, which include making a formal apology to affected communities. It also said that a draft version of the report had been delivered to Premier Tim Houston's government in February of 2024. That's about 20 months ago. Mi'kmaq chiefs, African Nova Scotian communities, and opposition MLAs have been calling for the Premier to make the report public. And yesterday, the province released a draft version. Vanessa Hartley is the co-founder of the Center for Environmental Justice. She oversaw the panel for a period of its work. We reached her in Shelburne, Nova Scotia.
Vanessa, how does it sit with you that it has taken so long and only under these circumstances for the government to make this draft report public?
It really is disheartening that, you know, communities have called upon this report since its due date in December 2023 to be released to the public for public consumption. And unfortunately, it's taken someone brave and courageous to leak this to the press to kind of get this attention and focus back onto the issue at hand.
You grew up in Shelburne. It's a historically African Nova Scotian community, not far from the Morven Road dump. And that is often cited as a key example of environmental racism. For people who aren't familiar with that story and that location, how has that dump impacted people there?
For our community, you know, it's really, it becomes quite sad when we only start to gather when we're grieving or when we've lost family members. To give some context to this, we were, you know, established Black loyalists that fought for our freedom with a hope and a promise of freedom here in the South End. So for us in our community, you know, our legacy and historical ties is deeply connected to this land. So, you know, in the 1940s, the dump was placed in the South End as they were looking for a landfill to get rid of household waste and other categorized garbage. The dump for about 75 years has exposed our community to ongoing environmental hazards, the water and air contamination and pollution that has seeped into our community. And so, you know, we're really looking at still creating awareness around this issue as we are, as you mentioned, one of the more historic cases across Canada of what environmental racism manifests as in this country.
Do you remember when you became aware of that concept of environmental racism, when you realized that you might very well have been living this for quite some time?
Absolutely. You know, I grew up in the South End playing with my cousins and enjoying my time. You know, I can remember riding down Morven Road and not realizing that it was a dump and just thinking that it was grass in a hill. But it would have been in 2019 when a community elder Louise DeLille had approached me, and she asked me after a speech I had gave at the Black Lives Matter march in Shelburne that I co-led, and she asked me, she said, "Dear, do you know what environmental racism is?" And I said, "No, I don't." And at that time I was advocating, you know, for system reform in education, because the racism endured was just, you know, very heartbreaking for our community. So, you know, this pointed me in a direction where I started to develop this love for community and wanted to see our community access clean water. And so that one small drop in the bucket has been a ripple effect in my life.
There are several recommendations in this draft report. As you know, one of the recommendations is, you know, it's urging the province to issue a formal apology to Mi'kmaq and African Nova Scotian communities. The premier has said that he wants, his government wants to meet with panel members before moving forward with an apology. If it were to come, what would that apology mean to you?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are some recommendations that I definitely can appreciate and respect. And one of them being the apology. I think that this is a first step, and this is something that community and grassroots grandmothers and water protectors have been calling on for decades. You know, in the space of environmental racism and injustice, most of the contents of this is stuff that we've already advocated for. We've already talked about this, and we've already pushed for this apology. So, you know, earlier in the year, we actually called on not just the province, but local, municipal, provincial, and federal government to apologize for the ongoing harm and lack of cleanup in these hazard sites. So, you know, we're really calling for reparations, but we're also calling for restoration.
The dump, to let our listeners know, it was shut down about a decade ago, back in 2016. What is there that's now? Right. What is it like?
Yes, that's correct. So the dump still looks very similar. So they are in the process. They have actually facilitated well monitoring. So they have drilled wells into the site to report on the soil, but also the water. So they wanted to know what was happening, and if community has been advocating for the right things, they wanted to prove that either they were right or we were right. And so the Dillon report that was released in 2023 outlines that there is contamination at that site, and there still today is contamination, and they're in the process of cleaning that up.
So this is just really after such a long time of waiting, another first step, another first phase of trying to get to where you and others want this issue to be. Are you more hopeful at this stage or less?
That's a good question. I was taught this once a long time ago, that to have hope is to be foolish, but to have faith is to be rooted in community and to be strong. And so I would like to have faith that as a society, as Canadians and as Nova Scotians, we'll take this on as our responsibility and do our due diligence.
Do you think there's a different level of push or political will at this stage? If not political will, at least, enough momentum to force the politicians to act?
Yeah, I think there's momentum to hold people accountable to their legislation. I think if you're the one that has committed to it, you need to see it through. You know, I think, again, holding the individuals that are in these positions of power and authority accountable for their decisions. And the words that you speak and you promise to people, they mean something. So show up accurately.
Vanessa, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much, Neil.
Vanessa Hartley is a co-founder of the Center for Environmental Justice. We reached her in Shelburne, Nova Scotia. We requested comment from Nova Scotia's Department of Environment and Climate Change, but we did not hear back by airtime. Rows upon rows of sculpted concrete cars put there by humans who want to send a message through the powerful medium of art. It sounds powerful, you may be thinking. I'm going to cancel my swimming lessons and go see it. But I don't advise that, because Leandro Ehrlich's work is underwater. To see it, you have to swim out 200-plus meters from the Miami coast. Now, the ocean might seem an unnecessarily inconvenient place to put a sculpture park, but it's not really for people. That ocean floor was once the home of abundant native Gorgonian corals, and they disappeared. You can guess why. Us. They got smothered by sand when we decided to build Miami Beach. But Mr. Ehrlich hopes to bring those corals, which are now grown in a lab, back. And if all goes according to plan, they'll make those cars their new habitat. Mr. Ehrlich's commitment to art for nature's sake reminded us of another underwater art exhibition. Last year, British Guyanese artist Jason DeCaris Taylor displayed a work off the coast of the Grenadine island of Carriacou to bring attention to rising sea levels. From our archives, here is Jason DeCaris Taylor.
It's an interesting piece. It's a series of origami boats with children inside. And they're made from a stainless steel and cement that actually sort of reflect the light and the surface of the sea around them.
Lots to dissect there. I'll start with the children. Why? And it's beautiful detail, and it looks like they're wearing school uniforms, if I'm not mistaken. Why do you want to use children to convey your message and your art in this piece?
I mean, you know, overall, this piece, you know, is about climate change and what the effects of a changing climate is having on, you know, small island nations such as Carriacou. And of course, you know, the communities that this will most affect, you know, obviously the local community, but, you know, in particular the youngsters on the island. So I wanted, you know, them to be portrayed in this installation and show how, you know, their future is very fragile.
And the materials, and you have many other underwater installations elsewhere in the world as well, the materials you use speak to the message of sustainability and environmental impact as well.
Of course. So each one of the sculptures is not only a sort of work of art, it's also an artificial reef. So they're designed to be colonized by the marine environment. They actually have hiding spaces and areas, you know, which creatures can escape predation. The surfaces encourage corals and sponges. And these particular boats will actually also have ropes and cords, which will be propagating corals on, that will also be grown and then planted out onto the reef.
I know artists are often hesitant to answer this, but I wonder what you hope people might feel when they're walking or swimming or looking at those children in those origami boats.
I mean, I just really hope that people, you know, start to sort of question, you know, what type of world are we leaving for the next generation? You know, I was in the Caribbean last year, and, you know, it was on the back of one of the biggest heat waves. You know, the some of the temperatures recorded in the sea were, you know, off the charts. There was mass scale bleaching, and you know, these islands were, you know, threatened by extreme weather events such as hurricanes. So, you know, it's a really, you know, fragile future. And I kind of hope people, you know, when they see the installation, sort of understand that message and understand how important it is that, you know, we try to protect these communities.
From our archives, that was artist Jason DeCaris Taylor speaking to Neil last year.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.